For this story to make sense, you have to imagine the world before air conditioning. Imagine having finished a full day's work and approaching a wood-framed church by a dirt road at night. The church is lit like a lantern against an inky sky, with the shadows of a few people hunched and sitting on the inside window ledges. As you approach, Townsend Davis tells us, you can see it is packed with people. A slow and fervent humming already has begun. Perhaps you packed some food and have a bag of it hitched under one arm. If the church is big enough, bare light bulbs are blazing in the kitchen out back. Once inside and blinking from the light, you take your seat on a scuffed pew. If it is any time other than the dead of winter, it is hot. The air is alive, not just with hymns and prayers, but with the continuous swish of fans, stiff paper fans, stiff paper squares on sticks provided by the local funeral home that bear the face of a bearded white Jesus. You join in the slow, measured singing of melodies well known and get ready for a night of testimonials, prayers, incessant appeals for money, and most of all, talk about freedom. People take turns telling their stories while the fanning continues. Stories like this. One old black man has gone to the courthouse and patiently withstood a maze of questions from a white registrar of voters. A sheriff's deputy has roughed up a neighbor. The white city commissioners, just awakening to the possibility of black voting power, are acting jittery. You hear tales of courage and of how just talking about civil rights, better known simply as that mess, is turning the town upside down. A preacher tells of big plans, and you join the roar of approval from the congregants. Your children will be in that brick school one day, will be voting soon. A college student explains how voting works now, and refers to the Justice Department in Washington as if it were just down the road. Terms of jail and bail are explained. You stand and volunteer for something, to carry someone to a rally or to house a student visiting from the north. The meeting ends with a prayer for a better day. That account from Weary Feet, Rested Souls by Townsend Davis. For nearly 2 weeks in early May of 1963, national and international audiences rose each morning to images of violence, confrontation, and resistance splashed across the front pages of their major newspapers. Black and white photographs paraded daily through the New York Times and the Washington Post depicted white police officers in Birmingham, Alabama, wielding high-powered fire hoses and training police dogs on nonviolent black and often very young protesters. A year later, conference leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. recognized the importance of such vivid imagery in galvanizing support for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. King wrote of the campaign in his book, Why We Can't Wait. The brutality with which officials would have quelled the black individual became impotent when it could not be pursued with stealth and remain unobserved. It was caught, as a fugitive from a penitentiary is often caught, in gigantic, circling spotlights. It was imprisoned in a luminous glare, revealing the naked truth to the whole world. For King, the visual media proved a crucial component in capturing fugitive brutality, holding it still for scrutiny and transmitting this naked truth to watching and judging audiences. King praises photography and film for their work of exposure, revealing through mechanical reproduction facts that had remained hidden and therefore difficult to prove. That from the study Imprisoned in a Luminous Glare by Lee Rifford. The intimate atmosphere of that church meeting and the powerful photographic images like those cited by Dr. King come together in an exhibition titled Selma to Montgomery, A March for the Right to Vote at Luzerne County Community College, organized by internationally recognized photographer Jim Gavinas of the school's faculty. Jim Gavinas is the recipient of the Gordon Parks Documentary Photographer of the Year Award. His editorial work covers a range of events, both large and small, with an emphasis on the music industry. He has created photographs for Sony Music, Columbia Records, Lost Highway Records, Merlefest, and Farm Aid. He has worked with more than 30 Hall of Fame musicians and is regularly featured in industry publications, and his work was selected for the North Carolina Bluegrass Hall of Fame. Jim Gavinas has exhibited his work and is represented in the permanent collections of the Southeast Museum of Photography, the Gordon Parks Center of Photography, the New York Historical Society, and Mother Jones. He has included a wide range of photographs in this current exhibition by Spider Martin, James Spider Martin, who created the most comprehensive visual documentation of the March 1965 events in Selma, Alabama, one of the most significant moments in the civil rights era. During the 3 years Spider Martin worked for the Birmingham News, his photographs won numerous awards, including Associated Press Awards for Best Feature Photography and Best News Photograph. The exhibition at Luzerne County Community College opens this Friday, January 19th, at the Schulman Gallery on the campus in Natticoke, just outside Wilkes-Barre. Jim Gavinas paid a visit to the WVIA studios with photographs and artifacts from the National Voting Rights Museum in Selma to talk about the show and how he came to do this work.
When I started in photography, I was really drawn to doing longer-term projects. And so one of the first projects I did was on the homeless. I did another project on death and dying. I traveled to Haiti several times trying to tell their story. I had moved back to Pennsylvania, and I was really looking for a new project, something new. And I had never been to Alabama before. And so I really went there to photograph the back roads, the rural communities, and to experience that for myself. And as I started traveling and meeting people sitting on their porch and hearing stories, I began to hear more and more about the civil rights movement. And I ended up in Selma. I visited with some people just on the street that I met, and I ended up in the National Voting Rights Museum, where a wonderful woman came out by the name of Joanne Bland, and we began talking. And she started saying to me that there were people there in Selma that I needed to meet and need to photograph. She mentioned Jimmy Webb, Annie Lee Cooper. There were one or two others that she had mentioned, but I did not know any of them. And flat out, Joanne just told me that I was naive. And I think some people may have been offended by that, but she was absolutely right. I didn't know this history, and I didn't know this happened in our country to this degree. And so I asked her to help me, and I asked her to teach me. And she did. She started taking me around and knocking on doors and leaving me in people's homes to hear this story firsthand from foot soldiers and as well as the leaders of the movement. And so the stories that I'm going to share at Luzerne County Community College and at the Schulman Gallery come directly from the people that were there. This isn't something that I watched in a movie. It's not something that I flipped through books and got little quotes here and there. These are experiences that I have learned living with these people, eating at their tables and sitting on their porches and their couches. I'm proud to say these people are my friends. And so they are trusting of me, and they share their story openly with me. They were so welcoming. Really, I landed, when I first went to Alabama, my intention was to go to a little tiny town called Smuti, which I just saw randomly on a map. When I got to Smuti, there was nothing there. But I was booked to stay in Alabama for 10 days, so I just started driving. And I found that anybody that I saw on a porch was fair game, and no one ever turned me away. They would offer me something to eat, something to drink. If it was getting dark, they'd offer me a place to stay. And it was overwhelming how kind everyone had been to a stranger. And so I was naive to that part of it as well. I didn't think that I was in any danger ever or anything like that. People were so welcome and took me in.
And so what did you start hearing that you wanted to learn more about?
I would have to say it was probably Bloody Sunday, which in March of 1965, about 600 people left Brown Chapel and they walked through the city of Selma orderly. They come to the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which puts you on the highway to take you to Montgomery. The Edmund Pettus Bridge is named after a Klansman. When they got to the top of that bridge, F.D. Reese will tell you that he saw a sea of blue, men with billy clubs, men on horseback. Ultimately, what happened is when they got to the bottom of the bridge, they were told they had 2 minutes to return back to their church. John Lewis, who is now a congressman, asked if they could kneel and pray before they returned, and the order was given to advance. At that time, the troopers began beating the people. The men on horseback started stomping the people, swinging billy clubs, beating people over the back and the neck and the head. Tear gas was shot into the crowd. Linda Lowry, who was a young girl at the time, 14 years old, when she heard the pop, pop, pop of the tear gas, she thought that they were gunning everyone down. People didn't know if they were running into danger or away from it. Joanne Bland said that one of the scariest things that she saw was a woman standing still on the bridge and a man riding a horse full speed over her. So when I started hearing these stories, it's not a TV show, it's real life. It happened in our country. I couldn't turn away. And I really feel a responsibility to tell this story. I wasn't there in 1965. Spider Martin was, who will be showing photographs along with me at the Shulman Gallery. He covered the events. He has over 3,000 images of the beatings and the trials that took place afterwards. So basically, he is showing the events, and then I am showing the people that are in his photographs, and I will be telling the stories that they have told me.
Tell us who Spider Martin is.
Spider Martin really is a iconic photographer, and he really had a great influence on changing our culture. Dr. Martin Luther King said that without Spider Martin and the photographs that he made, the photographs that will be exhibited at the Shulman Gallery, that the National Voting Rights Act never would have passed. So essentially what he said was that without Spider Martin, your ability to vote would be based upon the color of your skin. He is a powerful, powerful photographer. I have seen this exhibit, parts of it. I've been working with his daughter, Tracy, and she is also including images that have not been previously exhibited. And so this is a great opportunity for our community. It is powerful. It's our history. It's educational. It's something that people need to see and understand so that we don't allow it to happen again.
Take us back to 1965. We did not have social media, and things were much different in terms of getting the word out. Spider's pictures, where did they go? How did they get out to the public?
Well, he worked for the Birmingham newspaper at the time. And so initially they sent him to Marion, Alabama, which kind of set this whole march in motion. In Marion, Alabama, there was a march one evening protesting the arrest of James Orange. James Orange was sent by Martin Luther King to Marion. He was there to pretty much talk about the principles of nonviolence. He was arrested, and they decided that they were going to lynch him for coming to town. They actually tied a noose and hung it in his cell. So the people were outraged. The movement was outraged. So they planned a march to the jail. During that march, the troopers began beating the participants. Two of the people that they beat were the mother and grandfather of Jimmie Lee Jackson. Jimmie Lee Jackson went to help his mother, and a trooper shot him. And a few days later, he would die. Spider Martin went to cover that, and then he couldn't leave. He felt a responsibility, too. He knew that his images, if he could share them with the world, make them aware of what was happening, it could create change. And it's exactly what happened. So even though the people at the paper did not want to stir up trouble, they didn't want him going back there, Spider continued. Spider was beaten. He was threatened. Governor Wallace actually told the troopers that they needed to eliminate him because of the effect that his pictures were having.
And so he was grabbed by what was taking place and the importance of it and couldn't do anything else as a human being.
Yep. He felt obligated. He couldn't turn his back.
You also tell us that there were 500 people originally in the march. Tell us what happened about the swelling of the ranks.
Well, what happened is about 500 or 600 people started out at Brown Chapel on March 7, 1965, and had Hosea Williams and John Lewis lead them. That was Bloody Sunday. After Bloody Sunday, pictures were seen in newspapers. The nightly news saw live footage of the beatings of what had happened, and people began coming. That evening, people began getting in cars and on airplanes from around the country to come to Selma, Alabama. Immediately, it went from a few hundred to 1,000, 2,000 people in Selma, Alabama.
And again, because these images were so powerful of violence, we are all in this together.
Right.
People were coming. So it wasn't just African-Americans, it was white people and other people.
It was people of different ages, races, religions, really anybody that had a conscience came to Selma and supported them.
You have placed in front of me some remarkable images from someone who was there at that march. Please describe them for us. What kind of camera would that have been?
This is a Polaroid instant camera. But on a recent trip, I was just in Selma the week before Christmas, and I was visiting at the National Voting Rights Museum there. And they have been very, very generous to us in loaning us artifacts. They've loaned billy clubs and shoes that people wore in the march. But one of the things that they allowed me to do when I was down there is to sit in the archives and go through the files and really have history right in front of me. And you mentioned I'm a lover of music, and I came to a folder that was labeled Pete Seeger. And so these are images that Pete Seeger made as he marched from Selma to Montgomery. We can see there's a very close-up, intimate photographs of Dr. King, Coretta King, the front of Brown Chapel. He also has photographs of things like the Confederate flag on a license plate, the crowds of people, the marchers, and he even photographed some of the shotgun shacks along the way. And what would happen is, as the marchers would go by, these people would leave their homes and join in. And so what started as 500 or 600 people, then it grew to a couple thousand there in Selma. By the time the actual successful march occurred and they made it to Montgomery, there were tens of thousands of people there. It's remarkable, like you said, without social media, to go from a few hundred to tens of thousands. There's good people in the world, and we can make a difference. I think people need to know that. When I talk about this, it's impossible for me to leave out the violence that occurred, because it was real. It was horrible. But I also ask that people recognize the courage that so many people had, their willingness to sacrifice their own lives if they had to, in order to make this country better. That's remarkable. These are heroes.
And Jim, you also talk about them as your friends and as your family. Tell us a little bit about the emotional experience you had watching the film Selma with Oprah Winfrey.
The movie for me is difficult to watch. As you mentioned, these people have become my friends. I've been going to Selma for over 15 years. A few times a year. You know, I've spent Christmas Eves with these people and holidays, and I've lived in their homes, and they really are family. And so it's always been difficult for me to hear the stories from them or from them, their friends. But to see it on the big screen in front of me like that is very, very difficult for me. I compare it a lot to going to a funeral for me. When I leave the theater, and I've only seen it twice, I am exhausted. I am worn out. It's brutal. It's very, very difficult for me to watch.
Tell us about your Graham.
Well, one of the very first people that I met when I went to Selma, Joanne Bland took me to meet a woman by the name of Annie Lee Cooper. Annie Lee Cooper was this sweet, sweet woman. She passed away not too long ago at 100 years old. But she immediately took me in, and we sat on the couch, and she talked to me. And she didn't lecture me. She didn't tell me her story. She didn't think she really did anything. When I talk with these people, Every single person will tell you the same thing. What was I supposed to do? It was the right thing to do. And she was no different. And I would sit there and listen to her. And whenever I would go to Selma, the first place I would go was to Annie Cooper's house. And I'd knock on the door and she'd smile big and I'd go in. And, you know, one time she wasn't feeling well and I went to the store and...
You got her orange juice.
I would get orange juice and medicine and whatever she needed. And she always made time for me, always. One time we were at a tuxedo dinner. The Clintons were there. Martin Luther King's family was there. There were so many dignitaries. And at the end of the night, Miss Cooper asked if I would walk her out. And so down the red carpet, she didn't think anything of it, but that to this day is one of the highlights of my life that she would ask me that. So I do. I whenever I would go there, I'd always say, you know, she was my Gram down there. And of course, and obviously, if I got in any trouble while I was there, if I mentioned Annie Lee Cooper, everybody knew Miss Cooper.
We see her in the movie Selma.
One of the things, Jesse Jackson says that Annie Lee Cooper did not get the memo that it was a nonviolent movement. One day, while trying to register to vote, she was standing in a long line outside of the Dallas County Courthouse. Sheriff Jim Clark and his posse began coming through the crowd and taunting people, hitting people. This was normal. They would be beaten, jailed for being in that line trying to register. And Miss Cooper spoke out and said, "We ain't afraid of you." Jim Clark came down, and when he raised the club to hit her, Miss Cooper hit him first and knocked him backwards. There are several pictures of those police that beat her on the ground, people holding her down while other people beat her. One of the things that happened by this point in history is that photography was already making an impact. And so the sheriff had been told by the governor, "There's too many pictures of you in the papers." And so they threw Miss Cooper into a car. They took her down an alley and they beat her again. And then they took her and threw her into a jail cell. And Sheriff Jim Clark said he was going to the local bar, and when he came back, he would kill her. One of the deputies let her go. It's the only reason why Annie Cooper really survived. And she was this sweet, sweet lady. If you looked at her, you would really wonder how anyone could do that to her. But she was feisty, and she was really, really a terrific lady.
And did Oprah Winfrey play her?
Yes, yep, in the movie. And in one of the opening scenes, Oprah goes into the courthouse and tries to register to vote. And one of the things that happened is, it wasn't like today, right? Now you can go and register at a music festival. Back then, there were so many restrictions on Black people. They had to take literacy tests. They had to pay poll taxes. They had to answer questions like, how many bubbles in a bar of soap? And the opening scene is how she is treated trying to register to vote. And it's very difficult for me to watch. The beatings, the violence you know is coming. That emotional damage that occurs in that first scene for me is one of the most difficult parts of the movie to watch.
Completely humiliating.
Yeah.
Another person.
Yep. When my friend Ms. Burroughs went the very first time to register to vote, she finally had gotten in and she got to the counter to register, and the man held up a bag and asked how many jelly beans were in the bag. Quickly she responded, "I don't know." And he threw her out of the courthouse, told her that she had failed, used some words that I won't use. She went home and she told her mother that they don't even treat us like we're human. And her mother told her, "They will if you keep getting back in that line." It took her 10 times before she was allowed to register. It's painful.
Will we see a photo that you've taken of Annie Cooper?
Yes. There will be pictures of Annie Lee Cooper. And actually, last evening, I came across one where she is really dressed up, and I photographed her in front of, she was leaving church when I saw her one Sunday. And it's a small picture. Usually for an exhibit, I make larger prints. But because of the space in the Shulman Gallery, and I certainly want to show all of Spider's work, But I'm still going to put that one in, even though it's a little smaller.
You did mention that the people at the Voting Rights Museum in Selma have really been extraordinary in trusting you with these one-of-a-kind articles. So tell us about the shoes. When marching, we think about the feet, and there's so many wonderful quotes about putting one foot forward.
Right.
But you actually have a pair of shoes from marchers.
The National Voting Rights Museum in Selma really is a special place. It was started by foot soldiers. It's operated by foot soldiers. If you visit there, chances are there'll be a foot soldier there. If they're able, my guess is they'll walk over the bridge with you and tell you the story firsthand. It's a really remarkable place to visit. And now they have also opened their doors to share this outside of the area. They just want the story told. And so they were more than gracious. The club and the cattle prod that they have loaned us, they actually went to one of their permanent collections and opened up the glass cases and took them out and gave them to me. The jail shirt that Dick Gregory wore when he arrived in Selma and was jailed and beaten, along with his wife, who was pregnant at the time. The two of them arrived in Selma, Alabama. She was pretty far along in her pregnancy as well. And both of them were beaten. They have loaned me the prison shirt that he wore while they arrested him.
And that's right here on our table. And there are stains on that shirt, which we might interpret, is it blood?
Yes. This was donated by Dick Gregory himself. And those are blood stains that are on the shirt.
There's also what we tend to think of as a vest that highway personnel wear for safety in terms of reflection. But it was from a marcher.
It was. And it was a safety feature. One of the things is, if you learn about or listen to this history, Martin Luther King, everything was very organized. And the last thing he wanted to do is break laws, do anything that wasn't up to code. And so, like, even when they marched through town, it was two by two and it was orderly. They stopped at red lights, right? They did this. And so jackets were also a safety precaution. And so many of them wore them. When I go back every year on the anniversary of Bloody Sunday and I march across the bridge, it has grown significantly since I started 16, 18 years ago. Now tens of thousands of people come. But many of the foot soldiers still have the vest they wore at that time, and they're still wearing it. One of the remarkable things that happens now is some of those marchers still do the whole 54, 56 miles to Montgomery. Occasionally, the museum will run a slow ride. They will walk the first few miles, and then they take a slow ride to Montgomery. But some of the people walk.
And what age must they be now?
Oh, man. My good friend, Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson, that is a name that people need to know. She was considered the queen mother of the civil rights movement. She passed away a few years ago at almost 110 years old. Miss Robinson, I visited with her shortly before she passed away, and she had told me how she had just started a new program that once a week, young people were coming to her house and sitting with her for her to talk and for her to teach. I said to her, I said, you know, maybe you can take a break. And she said, God's keeping me around for something and I don't think it's to sleep. And so these people are active. The civil rights movement is not over. There are a lot of things that still need to be taken care of. Things can get better. In 1965, these people that you will see in the exhibit, they saw a country that needed to be better and should be better, and they took it upon themselves to make the sacrifice to make that happen. Those people, in August of 65, when the Voting Rights Act was passed, they didn't just all of a sudden like say, hey, we're done here, time to go on vacation. They all have continued to move forward and to fight for equal rights and justice and voting rights especially. I know the people there in Selma still are very, very active on election days. Very, they are very active in elections.
You've brought also photographs from the museum as well of the day and of the people involved. And again, some of the results of the brutality. And as you mentioned, you have the billy club and the cattle prod that were used against the marchers.
And one thing, and this is how it's been said to me, is on that day that became known as Bloody Sunday, anybody that wanted to come out and beat up black folk could do it. The local furniture store opened its doors, and people were allowed to come in and take the legs off of chairs and tables to go to the bridge and beat people. I don't know what to say. I'm speechless. But that's what it was like. That was the atmosphere. That's what it was like living at that time.
And yet you describe an experience of people who are kind, open-hearted. There doesn't seem to be bitterness. They just want to make a difference and make sure this doesn't happen again.
I am glad you brought that up, because there's a lovely woman, Alice West is her name. Alice West fed the marchers. That was her job. And the first time that I met her, I sat on the couch with her. And she began telling me these stories, and I started to cry. And I said to her, I said, how is it that you cannot hate me? You have invited me into your home. You've gotten me something to drink. And she said to me, she said, it has to stop somewhere. And I've decided it's going to stop with me. If I hate you, my children will hate you. And my grandchildren will hate you. And I don't want that. And she said, I cannot control everyone, but I can control my family. I've never forgotten that. It's still remarkable that someone could say that, that was treated like that. One of the other things that Alice West always shares with me is how at night she would see white people come up and put bags of groceries on her porch to help feed the marchers and the people of the movement. They couldn't do it during daylight because they would be treated the same way. They would lose their job. They would be beaten. Their homes would be bombed. But in the evenings, they would come and give her food. It's a remarkable story. It really is. One of the things that amazes me about this is that the changes that came from this, they didn't happen because of millionaires or high-powered political figures. It was just everyday folks making a difference in their communities. And it spread. You know, I teach at Luzerne County Community College, and when I hear people say, well, what am I going to do about it? Oftentimes I have to go into this story and point out that we do have a voice. And especially if you're doing the right thing, we can make a difference. These people proved it.
Award-winning documentary photographer Jim Gavinas of the Luzerne County Community College faculty speaking with us about the exhibition Selma to Montgomery, A March for the Right to Vote, opening this Friday, January 19th, with a reception from 6 to 9 p.m. and gallery talk at 7. It's at the Schulman Gallery at the Luzerne County Community College in Nanticoke, just outside of Wilkes-Barre. The show will run through February 21st. For more information, on the web, luzerne.edu, luzerne.edu. In recognition of Black History Month, the Luzerne County Community College Schulman Gallery is hosting a photography exhibit, Selma to Montgomery, A March for the Right to Vote, from Friday, January 19th through Wednesday, February 21st. The exhibit will feature photographs by Spider Martin, the world-renowned photojournalist who covered the Selma to Montgomery March and the Civil Rights Movement starting in 1965. The photographs will be shown along with more recent photographs of Selma by Jim Gavinas, LCCC assistant professor and, as we said, internationally recognized documentary photographer. This is the first time that photographs taken by Martin and Gavinas will be exhibited together. Several items from the National Voting Rights Museum in Selma, Alabama will be displayed, including, as we heard, shoes and clothing worn by the foot soldiers, arrest records, photographs, newspaper, magazine articles, a billy club and a cattle prod, handwritten notes from some of the marchers. The exhibit is opening with a reception this Friday, January 19th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Shulman Gallery. Jim Gavinas will present a gallery talk during the reception at 7. The reception is free and open to the public. For more information on the web, luzerne.edu, luzerne.edu. And to see Jim Gavinas' work, you can check his website, gavinasphoto.com. And his last name is spelled G-A-V-E-N-U-S, gavinasphoto.com.